I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians.
So I saw Killers of the Flower Moon.
I did too.
I thought it was great. I think that a lot of the main criticism I heard about it, and that I agree with, is that I think it does miss the mark as far as this is a white director telling the story from the main character's point of view, who's a white dude. And I think that it does fail to center the Osage the way they should be, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's largely their story and the way that they were being
murdered.
Murdered, but also even before, I mean, they were being taken advantage of. I mean, they were being fucked six ways till Sunday. And like, I do think that Scorsese did I don't know that anybody could have made a better movie without actually having like...
Well, he brought in Osage people and involved their culture and there was an authenticity in it.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that too and trying to figure out how you could tell this story, because one of the things that he did do versus the book that this was based on, a true crime book,
right,
was that it's called like the Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI, and the FBI is barely an element in this,
right?
And I'm glad that they take that part out, because that's probably the least interesting part of the movie.
And apparently, from what I've read, that was all Leo. I think maybe we should just put out spoiler warnings, just
sure,
real quick.
Spoiler warnings. I guess
it's kind of weird to talk spoilers when it's a thing that really happens.
Yeah, and yeah. I'm going to try and stay away from any specific plot points, just because
they also tell you at the very beginning of the movie what's going to happen, don't they?
Yeah,
they're like,
yeah,
these six murders are going to happen.
Well, and I think it's pretty clear. I think that I do think that was all Leo. Leo was originally going to be cast to play the Jesse Plemons role, and that was going to be a much bigger part. And then he was like, no, I want to be what's his face, which I think it's really, I remember after What's Eating Gilbert Grape, everybody was like, oh, this is the next Olivier. Mm-hmm. This kid is going to be great. And I just really think, I'm like, my God, it is so hard to play the kind of detestable, callow, cowardly fuck that he plays in this movie, and just plays so like,
but also kind of dumb. He's kind of dumb.
He's feckless. He has no guile to him. He is just an empty vessel. And like, my God, he nails it.
But that's the kind of weird, the conflict in himself, which should not be a conflict that would exist in anybody that has a real heart, is this sense that you get the impression that on some level he does love his wife, but not enough to not collaborate with his uncle in killing her family
and robbing
thing. Them.
If he was more evil about it, if he was more into it, then at least you could fully, at least that would be something, right?
Yeah.
But he's not a good enough person to resist, but he's not a bad enough person to buy in completely. He's just a leaf on the wind.
He's a surrogate for America in general.
He absolutely is.
Who can be in love with the idea of and to honor the idea that they're here, but also at the same time be involved with exploiting them,
right,
raping them, killing them, dispossessing them, making them just a means to an end.
It's kind of like he thinks as long as he's not the main person doing it, or it's not his idea doing it, or that he also loves his wife to some extent and also learns her language and his kids and stuff like that, as long as that he can somehow say like, well, I'm not doing that to you specifically, until they start telling him to put stuff in her insulin.
Yeah.
And, you know, he knows what it is, but, as long as I don't know, absolutely 100% for sure.
He never asks, right?
But he knows but he still doesn't question it enough, because he knows that if he does question it, he will know 100%.
Right, and that would make him more, yes.
Because he's a fucking coward.
He is. Their relationship, Molly, is it Ernest?
Ernest, yeah.
Their relationship is the microcosmic version of what's happening at large in that movie, because he's complicit but still gives himself deniability, right? I was just doing the best I could. I was just trying to do right by you, but also my uncle. First of all, anybody says you can call me king, red flag. That is a red flag right there. The other thing I kept thinking in this movie was, oh my God, Robert De Niro is playing he's the anti-Vito Corleone in this. Because if you've ever watched The Godfather 2, where he plays young Vito, his arc is very much like, oh, this fucking guy's taking advantage of my neighborhood. He's taking advantage of my neighbors. He's putting people at danger. He's extorting them. And then he basically gets rid of that dude. And then he replaces him and he creates a community. That's the whole point of The Godfather, is that, yes, he's a criminal, but he's not a bad dude,
yeah.
Right? Like, he wants to take care of his people. He wants to take care of his community. He wants his children to be successful. And, like, King Hale is like the end. He's just like, fuck these people. I want as much as I can get from them, and I don't care what happens to him.
But he wants to create the illusion that he's that Vito Corleone type.
He does.
He wants people to think, you know, I do care about you, and I am going to contribute $1,000 to hunting down the killer that I absolutely hired. You know, it's OJ golfing, you know, but it's like he does a much better job of pretending to not be like those other awful white people while being the worst white person.
Right, yeah, he is. It's funny. Fake allyship hasn't changed much in 100 years.
I can completely agree with you, Joe, that there is the disconnect of it being of Scorsese being an Italian American and then trying to tell the history of these particular people. However, it's really more Scorsese's telling a history of all of, like, the awful, 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 like, grifters and murderers and people of have no a total amorality who would be attracted to just naked wealth.
But I think we've also been primed as moviegoers with these specific kind of stories that you think, okay, so Leo DiCaprio is my hero. This is going to be the movie about how he finally sees what his uncle is, turns on him, and sides with his wife and her family.
Yes, because you're waiting for that moment. You are waiting for that moment. And I won't say whether or not it comes because I think that's a big
payoff. I will.
Payoff.
It doesn't. And he keeps thinking, like, he's like, well, I still haven't crossed that line of being a bad person yet. And it's like, dude, you've lived on the other side of that line.
Yeah. And I do think the reason Scorsese is so successful is because this is a mafia story. It is not a mafia story in the way that we are used to seeing it. It is unflinching. And I think he acknowledges, I think the way he chooses to end the movie acknowledges the fact that this is a show, right? Like, this is, he acknowledges, I don't want to say lack of depth, but the way in which there is a separation from the events you're seeing,
right,
and actually being a part of the people that experienced it, that had that done to them. And I thought, I remember seeing that ending and going, holy shit, I think that this makes this movie probably a good point or two better than it would have been without it.
Sure.
It really acknowledges any shortcomings in the movie while also kind of propping up the whole point. And it's weird because it's the second time this year where there is a moment in a movie by a major director that is like, it's meta commentary. And I'm like, oh, I dig it. I really like that because I think movies that when you can use meta commentary effectively, it's a very powerful tool.
Wait, what was the other movie this year that you'd say?
Asteroid City.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like the movie within a show.
Right.
And there's that point where Bryan Cranston is on screen in the dramatization of the play. And he's like, wait, I'm not supposed to be here. And you're like, I see what you're doing. There's a few moments in Asteroid City. There's also the scene where Scarlett Johansson is talking to Jason Schwartzman about the artifice of movies. And then she drops her towel and you get the full nude woman in the mirror, and it's clearly a body double.
Right.
It's clearly not her. And it's like,
pretty, wink, 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 not, pretty genius stuff.
Yeah,
pretty genius
stuff. It is. It is. We are in the age where, and this is a conversation we've had before, we don't have movie stars. We have brands.
Right.
Chris Pratt is not a movie star in the way that Steve McQueen was. Steve McQueen was a fucking movie star. Chris Pratt is a brand. He's actually a bland. Casey and I were talking earlier about how Chris Pratt is the anti-Keanu Reeves, because whereas Keanu Reeves...
You said that he was the anti-Keanu Reeves. I'm on the record for saying that Tom Cruise is the anti-Keanu Reeves, but go on.
if you go back a few years in the archives, we had a Keanu Reeves episode.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
the thing I said that the reason I love him is that he's genuine, he's charming, and he's good looking, but he's honest, right? There is a genuineness mm-hmm. to all of his performance. You can always tell he's in it. He never feels like he's phoning it in. And like every time he gives a bad performance, it's the fault of the director, right? And the thing people always like, well, his British accent in Bram Stoker's Dracula. I'm like, yeah, that was Coppola saying like, you need to have a British accent. Clearly he wasn't good at it. But like Chris Pratt, he's not, he's bland. He has no charm. He's not that great looking. And he feels just forced unless he's playing a character that is put upon. He works as Star-Lord because he's put upon. Because he's not the cool guy. He's the asshole. And everybody knows it except him. And even he kind of knows it. This is why he works as Andy on Parks and Rec.
I'm not sure if I've seen him in a role other than Star-Lord where I've been like, oh yeah, he really works.
I think you're right. It always kind of, I don't know, there's something off-putting. And I'm trying also not to take the fact that he belongs to some like homophobic church.
Yeah, yeah.
As a thing, I think like the internet decided like about a year ago that he was the worst Chris.
And oh yeah, I think he is.
He probably is. Most underrated Chris is Chris Pine.
I would agree. Yes.
I think the Dungeons and Dragons movie reminded me that this dude is just like a charisma supernova.
Yeah.
And the fact that
I thought it was the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie that reminded you of that. Didn't Splinter have a birthday party for the Turtles and he brought the three Chrises along?
Oh, yeah.
And they all unanimously agreed that Chris Pine was the best Chris.
Chris Pine is the best Chris, I think.
I think Chris Pine, yeah. I mean, he's also a better Kirk than Shatner, fight me.
What?
He is, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But I've also been Pike-pilled recently, so
Pike-pilled.
I'm like Captain Pike for the win. But yeah, I think Chris...
Anson Mount's a great paragon of masculinity as a character.
Yes, he is. Yeah. And
written really well and played really well by Anson Mount.
Just more good looking than any man should be. It's I watch that show and I'm like, God, he's dreamy. And then I'm like, yeah, no, I just said that.
I think that we live in this age, I guess, the movie star as a concept seems to be practically dead, that people don't go to movies to see an artist anymore. They go to see a continuation of a character or a franchise, which makes me really sad because there are some really great artists. I think Chris Pine in a movie star era could be so much bigger and have a so much more interesting career than he does now. Like I recently saw Patrick Willems is this guy on YouTube who does this. He did a video about the death of the movie star and tried to say, like, let's treat it like a murder mystery, who killed the movie star. And an example he uses at the beginning of the movie is, he said, let's look at the year 1988, and what is the biggest movie of the year? It's Rain Man, with Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman, and says that this mid-budget drama, as a family drama starring one of the biggest actors in the world, is that you get those kind of roles back then, where it wasn't just that he was a guy from Top Gun. It wasn't just that he would... It's that a movie got made oftentimes because he was interested in being in
it.
Right, a mid-budget drama was elevated because of a movie star.
Yeah.
That you had the power to take something and make... Because you wanted to see Tom Cruise do that. But now Tom Cruise doesn't even get roles like that anymore.
No.
That he's only doing the action brand now. Even when he wanted to do The Mummy, it was basically just another version of Ethan Hunt.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. That's a shame because I look at, say, Chris Pine and I go, this is a guy who, if Hollywood was structured differently, if we had been not for the past 20 years conditioned to follow characters rather than actors, artists, directors, he would have an incredible film renaissance. He would have this great mixture of both franchise action movies and dramas. And we would have seen much more interesting work from a lot of these people. Well, and it's such a shame.
This brings me around to kind of where our conversation started, right? Which is I've been thinking about the end of this year and award season and the movies we're looking at. So we have Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer was the, you know, Barbie was the movie of the summer, which makes me so happy. But Barbie is not like, I mean, is it an IP? Yes, but it's not like...
Barbie's also a bit of a unicorn movie.
Yes, where it absolutely is.
It's a franchise character, but I would say Barbie is most comparable to Into the Spider-Verse.
I fully agree. I fully agree.
It's an example of a piece of intellectual property. I almost hate. It sounds poisonous saying those words.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a piece of intellectual property from a studio and a company that has been flailing.
Yes.
And because they're flailing and they don't know what to do, they gave really creative people total creative control to do something interesting in a way that if they were in a height of their success, they never would have allowed.
Well, and it's the Logan effect too, right? Which is what happens when you have the star of your movie as a producer and she gives and they give a shit, right? Yeah. But then you have... What do you, at the end of this year,
I was going to say, maybe this is not necessarily a rebuttal of what you were just saying, Mike, but I will say Margot Robbie is a movie star.
Yeah.
There are some of them. Unfortunately, Chris Pine is not at that. I don't think he's at that level. I think he's incredibly talented and very charismatic, but it's really some things that are undeniable. She is 100% a movie star.
Yeah, I agree.
In the most classical mode of a movie star.
I would say she is an actor on the same level as the DiCaprio and the Brad Pitt, where they come into this career because they are physically like perfect. These are beautiful people.
Yeah, stunning.
Like stunning screen presences. And what they end up doing is kind of like pushing and saying, you know what? I want to pick weird shit. I want to stuff that will stretch my ability as a performer. And that you find underneath this beautiful face is like incredible talent.
Yeah.
And versatility, where you're like, all it really takes at this point, and I think in this world of franchise like domination, I think what Margot Robbie needs is like a auteur patron. In the same way that people like DiCaprio and Brad Pitt have people like Scorsese and Tarantino.
Yeah.
There just needs to be someone who goes, give her her movie with that amazing script from one of those rare directors that are left who can get those movies in theaters. And that's the thing that'll make people realize how great she really is. Because I think Barbie is one of those weird movies where, again, like I said, if Barbie was this property that had been making movies for 20 years and the last few of them have made $1 billion, this is not the Barbie movie they would have made.
Right, no, absolutely not.
This is
absolutely
the Barbie movie you made when everything you've tried to do, everything you've greenlit, every person you've attached to it has ended up falling through.
Right.
And you're just desperate, and Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach come along and they go, you know what? Fuck it. Fine. Do whatever you want. We don't know what to do. In the same way you get that Spider-Verse, which is if you hadn't had Sony just going, fuck it, we haven't figured out how to make money from fucking Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And you give a pair of directors and creators this incredible creative control and just leeway and get the fuck out of their way. What worries me is that the lesson of Barbie is not going to be that. The lesson of Barbie is going to be, we want to make more movies about toys. And now that we have this sort of like bullshit confidence from having a hit under our belt, even though it's not the producer's hit, it's Greta Gerwig's hit, it's Margot Robbie's hit, what they're going to do is go, well, you know, we have this big thing, so we're going to make the Polly Pocket movie, and we're going to make exactly the kind of cheap, safe garbage that the Barbie movie wasn't.
Right.
And then they're going to fail again until somebody actually looks at one of their products and says, I actually give a shit about that, and I have more to say about that than what you would write on the back of a toy box. And I want to talk about this, like, again, with Spider-Verse, with Barbie. This is a cultural phenomenon. This is a question of growing up. Spider-Man, Barbie, these are things that meant something to people. It still means something to people, but also mean a lot of complicated things to people. And rather than giving what, you know, the toy manufacturer wants, you explore the complicated shit.
And I think we often disagree about this, but I think, and this kind of dovetails into my thoughts for the movies coming up for the end of this year, right? 80% of what Hollywood has made over the course of its more than 100 years of being around is garbage, is forgettable garbage, because Hollywood is always chasing the high of its last high. And yeah, I have no doubt that you're right about that. I don't think Margot Robbie needs an auteur. I think she needs a workhorse director, because I think auteurs largely are not as good as they think they are.
Wouldn't you say, though, I'm very sorry to stop you right in the middle of a sentence, but wouldn't you say, though, that like that collaboration, say, between Paul Thomas Anderson and
Daniel Day-Lewis?
DDL.
Right.
Would be like, this is something where by the time you get to the Phantom Thread, you're like, well, they've already worked together. This auteur and this artist who's basically at the top of their game. They're just at the top of their game. What could it look like at you know, for Leonardo DiCaprio's third collaboration with Tarantino, or his fifth collaboration with Scorsese, or Margot Robbie's sixth collaboration with, you know,
Greta Gerwig.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
I think it's too early in the game to decide whether or not. I think the point I'm trying to make is I don't like the term auteur, and I don't think it leads to good art, because think the whole auteur theory leads people away from the essence of, I don't want to say good art, but good filmmaking. Because I look at like Chris Nolan, somebody who I would consider auteur, and I think his movies are messy. I think he falls into the same traps and same pitfalls every fucking time he makes a movie. And it's because he's so convinced of his own authority. Whereas I think somebody like Scorsese, I would not consider him an auteur. I think he is a workhorse director. He knows filmmaking in and out. He knows how to make a compelling film. And even like The Wolf of Wall Street, which to me was not in the same realm as, and I'm in the minority, but as something like Goodfellas or Casino, Killers of the Flower Moon is an extremely good example of that. Chris Nolan could not have made that movie. That movie would have been a fucking mess. And I think that, like, right now, we're seeing this kind of return, and I think partially it's due to the strike, but I think we're seeing this return to these workhorse directors, right? The movies coming out for the rest of the year, you had Killers of the Flower Moon next month, or this month, you have Napoleon, which is, like, one of Ridley Scott's big projects that have been around, talked about forever. You've got Michael Mann for the first time since 2015, since Black Hat, Ferrari. I'm super stoked about that. And then you've got, randomly enough, and crazily enough, Napoleon and Killers of the Flower Moon, both funded by Apple.
Yeah.
Who just clearly gave them a shit ton of money and said, go make us an Oscar-winning movie.
What's the corporation that has the most number of hundreds of millions of dollars to give out?
Sadly, probably Amazon.
Well, I think Apple's worth a lot more than Amazon is. And I love that. I'm like, am I the biggest fan of big corporations? No, but if they're just going to hang back and be like, make us an Oscar-winning movie, and they're going to...
I can't wait until Elon Musk starts taking X into movie production, and he starts trying to give $500 million to Steven Spielberg so he can release a movie under
be like, X. Spielberg will be like, I know you don't have $500 million, so no, I will not make Realist the Andrew Tate story for you, Elon. I'm sorry.
Wait, who would star as Andrew Tate in the Andrew Tate story?
Andrew Tate. Yes. It would definitely be Andrew Tate.
Adam Driver. Adam Driver could do it well.
Is there anything he cannot do? Yeah. I mean, he's got to be in Ferrari. He's a driver.
If you're gonna make it a parody, Keegan-Michael Key to play Andrew Tate.
Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Valverde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobias Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Friends.
Hello, I'm a human.
Say hi to Chris.
I'm Chris Pine.
Look at my eyebrows.
I'm the best, Chris.